And for today, we'll continue the discussion of the Satipatthana Sutta. And we're now at the midpoint of the retreat. So this is the point where you stop telling yourself, wow, I'm really going to practice well this retreat, I'm really going to get my head down and so on. And this is when you start making plans for what you're going to do when you finish the retreat. And how you're going to really keep your practice going after the retreat is finished. And it's not going to be like all of those other times. And you're going to keep find that peace of mind that you found on this retreat, you're going to keep it going after the retreat is finished. Here's a little secret. If when you finish your retreat, if you can keep your meditation going just as it was on the retreat, then all that proves is that everything the Buddha taught is wrong. Okay? Everything the Buddha taught is about conditionality. So unless you're an arahant, then your mind will be subject to conditions. And when the conditions change, your mind will change. That's all. So that's why we come on retreat and we change the conditions to be able to support your meditation. Finish the retreat, there's another set of conditions. Your mind will change. That's just how it is. So the important thing is not that you know, you're going to have the same states of mind off the retreat as you had on the retreat. The important thing is to understand, right? That's how your mind works. If you want to find peace of mind, these are the kinds of conditions that are helpful for peace and wisdom. Right? And so what I would hope is that rather than going back and then thinking, okay, I'm going to keep my mind just as it is or whatever, that when you go back, you can try to understand what are the conditions that's affecting my mind now. Why is it that my mind's like this? Why is it that it's like that? And so we get some clarity so that we can learn to understand these things. Anyway, so for today we're looking on to the observation of feelings, so the second section of Satipatthana. I'm going to endeavour, I'm probably going to fail, but anyway, I'll try to keep the session this morning a little bit short, since we're now in the heart of the retreat. Maybe better to spend a little bit more time meditating and a bit less time talking. But anyway, we'll see how we go today. So, does a monastic meditate by observing an aspect of the feelings? Here, when a monastic has a pleasant feeling, they clearly know, I'm having a pleasant feeling. When they have a painful feeling, they clearly know, I'm having a painful feeling. When they have a neutral feeling, they clearly know, I have a neutral feeling. When they have a sensual pleasant feeling, they know, I'm having a sensual pleasant feeling. When they have a spiritual pleasant feeling, they clearly know, I have a spiritual pleasant feeling. When they have a sensual painful feeling, they clearly know, I am a sensual painful feeling. When they have a spiritual painful feeling, they clearly know, I have a spiritual painful feeling. And when they have a sensual neutral feeling, they clearly know, I'm having a sensual neutral feeling. When they have a spiritual neutral feeling, they clearly know, I'm having a spiritual neutral feeling. In this way, they meditate by observing an aspect of the feelings inside and outside, and both inside and outside. They meditate by observing the reasons for the origination and the dissolution of feelings. And mindfulness is established that there are feelings, the extent necessary for knowledge of mindfulness. They meditate independent, not grasping at anything in the world. This too is how a monastic meditates, by observing an aspect of feelings. Okay, so in this analysis of feelings, now, of course, feeling in Vedana, the basic definition or basic understanding of it is not quite the same as we use the word feelings in English, but it's not too far different. But in English, when we use feelings, we often use it to mean emotions, which are quite a complex thing, whereas feelings or Vedana is not really talking about emotions in that complex sense. It's talking about the much more simple aspect of things, whether things are pleasant, painful, or neutral. So whether we feel attracted to it, repelled, or neutral about it. And of course, the more, if you like, the more sophisticated or high-level emotions sometimes are clearly associated with one or other Vedana. Okay? So you might have an emotion, let's say, of jealousy, okay, which might be sort of clearly associated with an unpleasant feeling. Okay. On the other hand, you might have an emotion like, let's say, celebration or rejoicing. Let's say you meet some old family members or something like that, and you're so happy to see that. It's closely associated with the sukha vedana, the pleasant feeling. But at the same time, you might also have other kinds of emotions which is associated with both pleasure and pain. For example, you might have a photo of a dead family member, right? And so that might bring up mixed feelings, you know, both happiness to remember them, but also sadness that they've gone away. So this is why those emotions are much more complex. It's kind of a higher order structure in our consciousness. So when we're talking about Vedana, always remember we're talking about that very, very basic. This is the first time we're looking at a mental quality, right? We're looking at one of the most primitive functions of consciousness, right? It's a function that you can discern in bacteria, right? I mean, you bring a painful stimulus to them and they'll cringe and move away. A pleasant stimulus, food or something like that, they'll go to it. So even at that very, very basic level of organisms, they have that same kind of reaction, painful, a pleasant, painful or neutral. Okay, so when we're meditating, of course, every experience that we have has some form of Vedana associated with it. Okay? Often that Vedana is very neutral. Okay? So that's probably the most common one that you experience, really, is just pretty much neutral feelings. In fact, neutral feelings are so common that you usually don't pay any attention to them. Right? We normally only pay attention to things that are either pleasant or painful. So neutral feelings we tend to get bored with, we're not interested in them. So in our meditation, all of these feelings are there and all of them will be part of the contemplation, part of that sphere of experience that we're having and part of our understanding of how our mind works as our mind goes on. One of the things that we learn through meditation, in fact one of the primary things that we learn through meditation, is to get a little bit of distance from our feelings. Okay? So we can sort of step back from them, we know that they're there. So this isn't repression of our feelings, right? It's not dissociation from our feelings, right? It's you're fully aware that they're there, but you don't let your feelings overwhelm you. Okay? You recognize it as a feeling, you understand that, but your feeling isn't determining you, right? Normally we react, or often we react in a fairly unreflective way to our feelings. Something painful happens to us and we react. Something pleasant happens, we move towards it. So through contemplating feelings and being aware of feelings, this is one of the main advantages that we get from this, is that we get a little bit of distance. We see that that feeling is there, we see our own response to that feeling, right? And we can kind of, through mindfulness, we can kind of step in and have a little bit of choice about that, so that we're not necessarily following our feelings, but we can use a bit of discernment. Now, when feelings, Vedana, are presented in the suttas, they're presented in many different ways, and there's one sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya which starts out with these monks arguing about how the Buddha analyzed feelings, and one of them saying the Buddha said there are 6 kinds of feelings, and the other one saying he said there are 18 kinds of feelings, and somebody else says, no, there's 36 kinds of feelings, and he says, no, you're wrong, he says, no, you're wrong, and so on. And they go to see the Buddha, and the Buddha says, yes, well, sometimes I talk about 3 kinds of feelings, sometimes I talk about 5 kinds of feelings, sometimes I talk about 6 kinds of feelings, sometimes 18, sometimes 36, sometimes 108 kinds of feelings. But it's not really worth arguing about. Okay, so these are just different ways of analyzing it, right? It's all the same thing, but just different ways of analyzing, which might have different purposes at a different time. So mostly, the most common kind of analysis of feelings we have is what I've mentioned already, pleasant, painful, and neutral feelings. There's also very commonly an analysis of feelings in terms of the 6 senses. So the feeling that arises dependent on the eye, the ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And then those can be further subdivided, so you have the 6 senses times 3, pleasant, painful, and neutral, so that makes then 18, and then you can divide that up into past, present, and future, and so on and so forth, hence you get the 108 or whatever. So, There are some other places where the feelings are divided in slightly different ways, but these are the most common ones. Now, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the analysis of feelings goes a little bit deeper than that, and this particular aspect is found quite widely in the versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, and it is found elsewhere in the canon. It's not unique to this, but somewhat rarely. It's only found a few places elsewhere in the canon. And we can see the main distinction here is the distinction between what I've translated as sensual feelings and spiritual feelings. The Pali words here are for what I've translated sensual is actually amisa, which is actually associated for a word meaning something like raw meat. So more literally you translate it as carnal feelings. Okay? Carnal feelings. But I was kind of wrestling with that. To translate it as carnal feelings is tempting because it's quite precise and quite, etymologically literal as well, but it's probably a bit archaic. And then the other word is the opposite of that, so it's literally uncarnal feeling, niramisa. So we translate it as spiritual feelings. And so these sensual feelings and spiritual feelings, one way of looking at them is that they're feelings which tend to lead towards suffering and feelings which tend to lead towards liberation from suffering, okay? So the interesting part about it is that the spiritual feelings, which are the feelings to be developed, can be either pleasant, painful or neutral, as can the sensual feelings or the worldly feelings. They also can be painful, pleasant or neutral. So we can't say that it's not the case that, pleasant feeling is always good or the painful feeling is always bad or vice versa. Actually, all three of those feelings can play their role. Now, some cases they're fairly obvious, right? If we look at the sensual feelings, amisa feelings, so sensual, pleasant feeling, fairly obvious, right? So you can experience pleasure through your senses, through eating food and having sex and all of those kinds of things. And so that gives you some pleasure in the moment, but it also tends to agitate and disturb your mind, tends to make you feel very kind of inflamed and very hot. Your mind feels very restless. There's never a sense of contentment with that. There's always kind of you wanting more. And so it gives you some pleasure and some happiness, but the pleasure and happiness it gives you is quite limited. And it always comes with a lot of drawbacks as well. So this is why that kind of feeling is not going to be very conducive to liberation. Then there's the sensual, painful feeling. Okay? And that's a bit less obvious. What do you think it's talking about there?
Addiction.
Addiction? Mm. Right? Yeah, addiction or I guess any kind of depression or anxiety and things like that. Yeah, I mean these are things which are dragging you down. Yeah. Any other suggestions? What about physical pain? Is that something which would be classified as like spiritual or sensual or how? Well, anxiety would be associated with negative, painful feelings, yeah? I mean, but again, it's a kind of higher order construct, right? So you might be a person who's suffering from anxiety, right? But then you might also be able to have a laugh about your anxiety from time to time, right? So at that time you actually experience, you still have suffering from anxiety, but you have a pleasant feeling. But this is why these things, they're not identical, but it's associated with painful feeling. But yeah, so for painful feelings associated with anxiety, right, because they tend to be associated with the negative mental states. Anything else?
How would it affect
the physical
negative feelings
would be natural and the mental negative more? So you divide up into physical and mental. There are other elsewhere in the suttas where it does divide feelings in that way, right? So you have another division of feelings where it divides. You have like dukkha and dominasa is the physical feelings and the mental feelings, physical pain and mental pain. and sukha and somanasa is physical pleasure and mental pleasure, so that distinction is made. But if that was the case, okay, so let's follow that through. If in this case sensual painful feelings is physical painful feelings, okay? Spiritual painful feelings is mental painful feelings. Does that mean that if you discover that your boyfriend is cheating on you and you get upset with him, that that's a spiritual sensation? Well, it might lead towards letting go, but, but it might not be. That's right. Exactly. The revenge fantasies might be very satisfying. Yeah. Yeah. We haven't got onto that. We're still trying to figure out what's the worldly painful feelings, the sensual painful feelings. The reason I'm asking the question, because let's for example just consider physical pain, right? I mean, physical pain in itself is kind of ethically neutral, right? I mean, it has a function, right? It's useful. You can remove yourself from a source of danger, but it also often tends to be associated with unpleasant or unwholesome mental states, right? When you hurt yourself, you tend to get annoyed and angry or something. On the other hand, if you're meditating and you experience pain, then it can be the opposite. It can actually be associated. You can feel the pain and it might like wake you up, or it can, you know, make your attention become sharper, right? So you can experience a painful feeling and actually have a positive outcome from it, right? Same thing can happen in your life as well. You can experience pain. Maybe maybe to revisit that scenario, maybe you discover your boyfriend's been cheating on you, you get really angry with him, and then you decide, stuff this, I'll become a nun. So, so you know, it can have a positive outcome. So this is the kind of the point. So what's going on there? Certainly helps, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. One of the ideas is in the suttas that it uses is this idea of things which are like stimuli, right? Contacts and stimuli, which are trying to figure out an English idiom for it, but which are apt to produce a certain kind of response, tend to produce a certain kind of response or something like that. And so, you know, something like pain, right, is physical pain, is normally kind of apt to produce a response of aversion towards it. Right? That's kind of normally it's associated with the feeling of aversion towards the physical pain. Right? But of course, that's not fixed. Right? That's the point. And so if you have mindfulness and you have some wisdom and you have some reflection around that pain, you can change your response, right? So you can have a physical pain and then have a wholesome response to it, or a skillful response to it. Right? So this is why these things, when it's introducing the sensual and the painful and the worldly, sorry, the sensual and the spiritual feelings, then there's a little bit of wiggle room or flexibility about how these things are, right? It's not necessarily that the same vedana, the same feeling you have, can produce quite different responses depending on your state of mind. Yeah? And I'm sure this is something you've all experienced during the retreat, you know, that these things change. Maybe the same thought might have come up, you know, maybe an unpleasant thought came up at the start of the retreat and you were thinking about somebody like this or something. And then later on the retreat it comes up and you realize, oh, you know, you think about the person quite differently. I mean, it's quite a different emotional response.
But nothing fixed, none of these, but, I mean, they're all transmutable?
I think so, yeah. I think in a certain sense, like a physical sensation, is, you know, that's pretty automatic, you know, but how you respond to it is
Like training for politics or something, you know, go to a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, that is a kind of mix, isn't it? Because on the one hand, yeah, it's about kind of glory and fame and sensual things like that, but it's also about like building self-confidence and reliance and so on. So it has a wholesome aspect as well. Yeah. Most of the things we do in the world are kind of like that, you know. They're rarely, I mean, obviously there are some things you can do which are entirely unwholesome, but most of the things we do in life are, they're actually like a mix of things. So what about, okay, so we've looked at painful sensual feeling. What about painful spiritual feelings? What does that mean?
Doubt?
Mm-hmm. Okay, like what kinds of doubt?
Doubts about your practice, that it's leading you in the right direction.
Okay. Yeah,
I had that at the beginning of the retreat.
Okay.
But
and
it's resolved now.
It's resolved now. Okay, excellent.
Very good. Just now.
Right this moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Existential angst, such as. What am I doing here? Why am I on this retreat? Go on. Yeah? Any other thoughts on that? Sorry? Feeling sore while you're meditating, right? So you have those kind of feelings and something you wish that you were free of them. It would be nice if you could meditate and not have any pain. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Remorse, you know, sort of kind of a little bit in the past, that if you have a thought that, oh, I'm so healthy, I have so much of advantage, you know, to make more effort, you know, now and in the future, and then you have that one more spiritually that, oh, why didn't I even back then, you know, but then that can for some people, or sometimes in myself, you know, feel a little bit more future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I guess it's that any form of grief, hatred, and delusion really the experience is ultimately a spiritual.
Mm. Why is it spiritual?
Well, because it's driven by the mind, rather than it's not kind of. Well, I guess I'm defaulting back to the, you know, the uncalm sort of style, which is pulling away from. Cutting color and, you know, craving towards or sort of confusion, all those states are not physical. That's physical expressions, obviously.
Right.
But, so that's like why spiritual is certainly not physical.
Yeah, I don't think it means spiritual in that sense. It means spiritual in the sense of leading towards the goal.
Right.
You know? Spiritual in the sense of leading towards what's skillful, what's wholesome, or what's free of suffering.
So this is about the akusa of the future.
It's yes, very very much so. Yeah. In the sorry, hey?
Taking that interpretation, I've understood it before, it seems to have a much clearer purpose now in terms of the meditation. Like,
okay.
I didn't really get it before in terms of what's the point of this, but
yeah.
That makes what you're saying. There's a big benefit.
Yeah. In the elsewhere in the Vedana Sanyutta, it defines these terms more precisely, and it defines this particular term as the longing that the sadness or painful feeling that you have when you have the longing, when will I experience that blissful liberation that the noble ones enter and abide in? And so that's I think, you know, very very close to what a lot of people have been saying here, right? It's that kind of feeling, you know, perhaps a remorse that you know, why didn't I practice harder, or, you know, feeling to the future, when is it going to be, and maybe looking around the room and see everybody else meditating so blissfully and so happy, and like, oh, how come they've all got jhanas and I'm still here struggling? And, you know, sometimes maybe you look back at your own practice and think, oh, I've been meditating for years and haven't got anywhere, what's going on? And all of those kinds of things, yeah? And so it can be quite sad, or maybe like doubts about your practice and these kinds of things. And so it's normal that these things are a part of your practice. So to me it's actually quite, it's almost kind of, I find this that idea very reassuring, you know. It's actually the Buddha's kind of recognizing that these things happen, you know, and it's okay, you know, it's part of your path, it's a normal thing. And you recognize that. And like all of these feelings, you know, it's not a matter of getting rid of them or doing anything about them, but just accepting it. That's natural that you'll feel like that sometimes. And so you can recognize the feelings, you know what they are, but you don't let those feelings overwhelm you. Right? Don't let it turn into despair. It's okay to have some doubts. It's natural to have some doubts from time to time, right? It's normal. It's okay to, you know, worry, oh, maybe I should be putting forth more effort or whatever. It's natural. And, you know, the Buddha wasn't the Buddha wasn't dismissive of people when they had these kinds of issues. I'm thinking of the context like, say, the Kalama Sutta, where the people of the Kalamas say to the Buddha, you know, here we have all of these different people coming and giving us different teachings, and we don't know which one's right and which one's wrong. And of course, that's something that's come up a number of times in this retreat, hasn't it, right? People say, oh, but this, you know, so-and-so's teaching like this, and so-and-so's teaching like this, and which one's right and which one's wrong, and what should I do? Are they all really the same? And now I'm doubtful and confused. And the Buddha's response to that was, well, you're doubting in a doubtful manner. Yeah? That's a very nice response. He's not dismissing them, right? He's actually listening to them. Yeah, actually it is doubtful. It's not easy to know what's right and what's wrong. It's not easy to know what's the best way to be practicing or what's really true and so on. And so it's quite reasonable to have doubts about those kinds of things. Right? And so the approach we do with wisdom, if you have the mindfulness, you recognize those things, and then, you know, there are sometimes when you can reflect on those doubts and when you can overcome them. Okay, for example, sometimes you might say, okay, well, look, I'm not sure should I practice this way or that way. And sometimes you can just reflect it and say, well, look, let's give it a go. I'll spend 3 days meditating like this. And then I'll spend 3 days meditating like that, and then I'll see how that works. Right? You actually try that, and then at the end of it, you maybe say, oh, actually, this one worked really well. You know, I really enjoyed that practice, so I'm going to keep doing that. So there are some times when you can solve those doubts quite simply. And so this is where we use our investigation and inquiry to overcome them. But then there are other times when we have those feelings, and there's really nothing much to do about them, right? And especially when those things go much deeper, you know, and it's maybe kind of like an underlying disquiet or an existential angst or any of these kinds of things, and it's not so obvious what the cause is, right? And you can't just sort of reflect on it or solve it in any particular way. And that's also, it's okay. You just bear it in mind, you understand it, you know it, and you keep on practicing. And sometimes you'll find that as you keep on practicing that those things will drop away all by themselves. So however it manifests or however it shows itself, we're all going to experience those times when we feel those spiritual painful feelings, and it's important to acknowledge that they are part of the path.
spirit might be towards something is curious that central image of letting go of Christianity by passing the cross. It's crucifixion is painful to obviously there's liberation after when he was raised.
Okay.
But the actual act itself is quite painful. And put all right effort on the noble part.
Right.
Which, in a sense, painful, otherwise, you know, being, you know, we all ordained and practice happily and that sort of thing. There's not really a priority in good reason for that sort of activity.
I don't know, what do you mean for?
Like practicing and the letting go process can be painful sometimes.
Can be, yeah. I'm not sure what you mean when you say that there's no part on the Buddha's part.
Like
you mean like in the like the actual path or something like that? Or
there's no idea letting go of the extremely
visible
sort of thing.
Right.
But actually it's
interesting. That's more complex, yeah. It's true. I mean in the normal kind of the sort of standard teachings on the path, you don't find that. But it is mentioned, you know, a number of times, especially in the stories. You know, you have the story of the different kinds of holy life, for example, and you have like the painful way of practice with different results. Yeah? So the four kinds of path is painful practice with slow results, painful practice with quick results, pleasant practice with slow results, and pleasant practice with quick results. Yeah? So Ajahn Brahm said when he first heard that teaching, he's like, I'm going to do that last one. You know? So that is kind of acknowledged, you know, that sometimes it's like that. And it talks about, with one sutta, it talks about a monk who every day gets up and they live the holy life with weeping and wailing, with tears running down their face every day, but they keep on doing it, you know. And in the Tarantara Igata, you have lots of examples of the monks and nuns who are suffering from, you know, very serious despair. You've got one of the famous ones of the nun who was like, here I am for 20 years, I've been living as a nun, and in that whole time I haven't experienced peace of mind even for as long as a fingersnap. Mm. Mm. So taking a rope, she tied it around the branch of a tree and she stood there, and as she put the rope around her neck, her mind was freed. Don't try this at home. Well, I think if it's really right effort, I think it's very pleasurable. I think on the way to it, as we're purifying it, then it can be either, you know, sometimes painful, sometimes pleasurable. Yeah, I mean, we're all going to go through times when you're meditating and you're feeling really sleepy or whatever, and you're like, oh, you know, and it feels really unpleasant. But when your energy starts to kick in, it's fantastic. Yeah. That is pretty extreme, yeah. In fact, that's very extreme. In fact, that's probably the most extreme story in the whole of the Pali Canon, right? So, well, what can you say? You know? I mean, the mind is a funny place. Yeah.
Well, it took 20 years to get to that point, right?
It took 20 years to get to that point, yeah. Yeah, and she's like, you know, I couldn't reach the higher goals of the holy life, so I was intent on the lower goals, fame and getting lots of stuff and so, you know, that's one of the things that's nice about those books, the Tarantara Igata, is that they sort of, see, when you look at something like the gradual training in the suttas, it talks about, you know, sort of the lifestyle of the monastics, and it's like, you know, you go for alms round and you collect your food and then you come back and after finished your meal, you sit down cross-legged and set your body straight, and then you like abandon the hindrances and develop the four jhanas, and then the higher kinds of knowledge, and then see the Four Noble Truths and let go of all your defilements, you know. And it's like, oh yeah, it's pretty straightforward, you know. It's a, you know. And so what those things show you is, well, that's like a, you know, it's like a template or an archetype, you know, and the reality of how people live that is very, very different. And the same thing you find in the vineyard as well, you know, there's lots of cases of, you know, bad monks and bad nuns doing all kinds of bizarre things, you know. And so, you know, that spiritual life is very, it's, you know, the way we actually live it, the way we experience it is very broad. And very ambiguous and very complex, and so the teachings give us like a framework to orientate our lives within that. But the way we do it is our own. Yeah. Okay.
I like when you mentioned about the word framework. Just put it in a practical way. So because this is in July, I just came back from a before I came to the intention. I just came back from the company, the management, so we have to define our KPI for this year.
Okay.
For ourselves, for our team. One, anyway, a lot of management and even self-discipline or self-management, if you want to put something, a goal, use a SMART method.
Okay.
It's M-A-R-T, specific. Yes, specific. We want to be Nirvana.
Okay.
M, because it's measurable. Maybe. Okay. Then the A, is it attainable? Well, definitely not in this life.
Yes, it is. Of course it is.
It's possible, that way. It's possible.
It is.
So it's practical.
No, I'm not. I don't really mean being practical.
Or you may be about it, but in this case for me.
Of course it is. I wouldn't be teaching it if I didn't think you could all get enlightened. Why would I waste my time? The Dhamma is sanditiko akaliko, right? What do those words mean? We recite the recollection of the Dhamma, sanditiko and akaliko. What they mean specifically is that you can attain it in this very life. That's what those words mean. It's a fundamental characteristic of the Dhamma. And the Buddha said, I teach the Dhamma not for what you can reach in future lives, but for what you can reach in this life.
Yeah.
Well, that's right, we studied the Tana Sutta. Yeah? 7 days. Yeah, how many? We're getting close. Anyway, so attainable, we've got attainable. Measurable, I think it's measurable, it is. I mean, it's not measurable in terms of being like, I guess, quantifiable, but it's measurable in terms of the sense that you can see the results within yourself. You know, okay, formerly you had that dukkha or whatever, and you don't have that anymore. So, yeah, you can actually see that. Yeah. So go on, what's the other one? Smart, attainable, what's next?
Realistic.
Time? I mean, there are some people who take that very kind of literally, you know, they come to the monastery and they're like, oh, you know, I'm going to come and stay for a few weeks and get the enlightenment stuff out of the way and then I can go back to work.
There's a book from, I saw in the question, one of the chapters, I don't remember the title, but one of the chapters say, the enlightenment is a full-time job. It's really attracted me, but I haven't got something to read. So I come back to my job and then
take your job.
No one has any full-time jobs anymore, do they?
Full contract.
Hey.
This is Doris and Nan. I'm just wondering whether, if you think that maybe she's for suffering so intensively that just that's what caused her to let go.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is it like, can you see suffering too much?
Yes.
Where you can really focus on suffering, seeing suffering in everything
all the time. I mean, it was pretty touch and go, right? Yeah? I mean, if her insight had been weaker, then she would have been finished and that would have been it, right? You know, it's a high risk path.
What about compassion?
Uh-huh. What about it? Oh, it's compassion. It can be, yeah. That's right, yeah. Compassion is an interesting one because compassion, you know, begins with an understanding of suffering, right? Your own suffering and suffering of others. As opposed to like metta. So metta is always focused on the positive feelings, right? So it's very, very, very straightforward, very simple. Compassion is kind of richer and subtler. And it always needs to go with wisdom. And if you don't have enough sort of self-acceptance, self-awareness, enough wisdom, then, you know, you can over-empathize with suffering that you see, and instead of causing you to become freer, it can actually make you despair. And this is a very well-known phenomenon in like activist circles and things like that. They call compassion fatigue.
Would not be selfish anyway.
Yeah, no, actually, sure. Yeah, you can still feel sadness.
So that much. So the sadness and then compassion.
Well, it depends on what kind of sadness it is, but it can be, yeah. It can be. Yeah, okay.
Is it true that I
eventually
compassion becomes sort of depersonalized, and it's just sort of when you see suffering, you just see it as just a generalized suffering, so I can just see it as suffering rather than seeing sort of seeing it in a broader, not in the sense of not feeling for that individual, but in the sense of seeing it in a broader context,
which is
suffering as well.
Sure. Yeah.
Does that
help you? Well, yeah. I mean, the story that's most helpful for me in that one is the story of the it's an old Chinese story of the turtles beached on the beach. You know that story? Man was went for a walk on the beach and then saw another man, and this beach for some reason. All these thousands, millions of turtles had beached themselves up there. They're all dying in the sun. And a man went down there and he saw another man on the beach, and he was picking up the turtles one by one and putting them back in the water. And he went up to him and said, "What are you doing?" He said, "You can't. There's like millions of these things here. You can't possibly save them all." He said, just thought about it for a minute. He said, "No, but I can save this one." So part of that, you know, the part of the kind of the wisdom of that is keeping some kind of perspective about what we can actually do, right? You change what you think you can change. And, you know, so often we lose sight of that. Yeah. Okay, good point. Yeah.
Is it like the book itself isn't subject to measurement? It was all the experiences comes out of our culture contact. Because the contact is a point of contact that gives rise to the outcome of this world, which is there. So it's actually not the book itself that causes the feeling to them, the way to them. It is that contact, and then the feeling to them like this.
I'm not sure what you mean by saying it's not the dukkha that causes the feeling to them.
Well, the dukkha is there regardless of how you feel about it. So the fact that the dukkha is
who's there regardless of how you feel about it.
Okay,
I'm
trying to sort of understand why I'm looking at it. So,
yeah.
So the dukkha is the craving for the central pressure of craving for being a craving.
No, that's the cause of dukkha.
That's the cause of dukkha. You're right. First, then, we can backtrack.
the legion of sickness.
Challenge that idea. I mean, all experience has some kind of feeling tone or some Vedana associated with it. Of course, there's a difference between dukkha as a feeling and as what they call like sankhara dukkha, or the dukkha of conditioned phenomena, right? So on a deeper level, everything is dukkha because it's not nirvana. So nirvana is the only thing that's not dukkha. Yeah, because nirvana is peaceful. Everything else is stressful because it's dependent on conditions.
But people
do. I don't have suffer all the time.
So
except they don't have, the only one that they don't have is the dominus, painful mental feelings.
So why do arhats, once they've experienced devotion, just go, oh, I'm out of here, do what some do, which is going to build themselves,
the people fight,
the life spirit, which is going to go off.
Yeah, sure.
Not suicide, you're going, I'm just
spiritual suicide.
Yes.
Because they're neither attached to nor repelled by it. They just understand it. Just dukkha. Like that thing that Socrates said, like a worker waiting for his wages. I wait my time. But you know, either arahants or very advanced monks or nuns know that their time is up, then that's what they do. They're not attached to life. And there's plenty of stories about that in the different traditions. But when I was in Bodh Gaya a number of years ago, everyone was talking about this event that had happened like a week or two before I got there. So this would have been about when 2007 or 2008 or something. And I was talking to some of the people there, and apparently everyone was talking about it, but like a week or so before, there was this Bhutanese nun, an old nun, who had been sitting around the Bodhi tree somewhere, and she just caught flame and burnt up, spontaneously combusting, and just that's it, she was gone. The police were called in and they investigated. There was no petrol, there was no matches, there was nothing flammable there, and she just went up in smoke. So that's pretty cool, right? That's how they do it. So either presumably, you know, she was very enlightened, you know, very advanced. I don't know whether she's enlightened or whatever, but very advanced meditator, who sort of knew that her time was coming up, you know. You can know that the sankharas are coming to an end. And then she said, okay, that's it. Maybe, of course, it's always possible that she was doing this Tibetan heat practice where they cause a fire and she forgot to turn the thermostat down. And but hopefully it was the former.
Did they find it out, really?
I'm not sure. I think it was just, if I remember correctly, it was just ashes remaining. Yeah. But I'm not entirely clear about that detail, so it might not be correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean those things are very different. If you're using external things. I mean, I can imagine that you'd feel the pain but not, you know, be equanimous about it. But if you're doing it just through your meditation, then you're in deep meditation, I don't think you'd even be aware that it was going on necessarily. Just happens. Anyway, so we don't need to talk about self-combusting nuns. Okay, so feelings, we talked about the pleasant feelings, and then we have the neutral feelings, right? So you have the neutral worldly feelings and neutral spiritual feelings. Huh? Now the difference between there is knowledge or awareness, okay? So normally what tends to happen is with neutral feelings, in Pali it says adukkhamasukha, neither pleasant nor painful. Okay, so to translate that more idiomatically in English, we use just neutral feelings. And because neutral feelings are kind of boring, and we don't normally pay attention to them, right? The whole purpose of feelings, the function of them, is to draw attention to things that are kind of interesting, right? And so the fact that something neutral is like, you know, you've got a smoke alarm which isn't ringing, right? No one pays attention to smoke alarms unless they're beeping, yeah? And so that's the whole point of neutral feelings, is to be there and not be noticed. And so in ordinary life, that tends to give rise to ignorance, right? So I mentioned this idea before, that the different kind of feelings are apt to create certain kinds of responses. So the normal response that a neutral feeling tends to give is a response of ignorance, right? You don't pay attention to it, you don't know about it. But in meditation, we learn to pay attention to neutral feelings, right? And when you're doing like body scanning or, you know, moving your mind through different parts of the body, you'll notice that there's always a tendency that your mind will gravitate towards a painful feeling or to a pleasant feeling or something like that. And so you should like consciously choose also to pay attention to neutral feelings, right? So choose pay attention to your elbow or to different parts of your body where you're not feeling anything in particular. And just to spend some time looking at that, you realize that those neutral feelings actually have their own particular kind of, you know, tone to them. It's not that there's nothing there, but it's just neutral. So through our practice, we can learn to make these neutral feelings conscious. Now, if you look at how these feelings tend to evolve in the Buddhist practice, you'll see that the neutral feelings usually become predominant at a very advanced level of practice. Okay? So that when you're practicing, initially you come from suffering or something like that, and then you develop meditation, you experience the joy and the happiness of meditation and these kinds of things. And then in the higher levels of meditation, you go to like the fourth jhana, which is characterized by neutral feelings, or you go to like the fourth brahma vihara, which is based on equanimity. In the practice of awakening as well, equanimity is towards the end, and so on and so forth. So in all of these cases, the equanimity is like an outcome. It's what happens when the pleasant feeling becomes very more and more and more and more subtle, until eventually that neutral feeling is actually more pleasant than the pleasant feeling. Okay? It's more peaceful. And so once the pleasant feeling, in a sense, has done its job, then the mind can rest in that neutral feeling, which becomes much more stable than any pleasant feeling is, right? Because of any pleasant feeling has a pull to it, right? It might be very subtle, right? But that's the whole point of pleasant feeling. It pulls your mind towards it. And because it has a pull to it, there's always a subtle tension in it. It's never completely peaceful. And so as that becomes more and more and more and more subtle during meditation and so on, the ultimate outcome of pleasant feeling comes back to a neutral feeling. Okay. So that's the normal way that neutral feelings are placed within the Buddhist path. Okay. Now, when we're meditating, of course, we can come from that perspective of that neutral perspective or equanimous perspective, and we can do that right from the beginning of our practice, right? That we learn to have a bit more of a neutral, objective attitude towards things, okay? But just be careful about spending too much time there, okay? Based on equanimous feeling or neutral feeling, your mind will never go to deep meditation, okay? It doesn't happen, right? Some sukha nisa samadhi, right? Sukha, pleasure, is the vital condition for samadhi. So your mind won't go to deep meditation unless you develop the pleasure. Okay? So yes, some periods of time when you develop those neutral meditations and just bare awareness and mindful and watching things, that's great. But also you need to develop those pleasant feelings. Actually, when you develop the meditations with the equanimous feelings, right, so you can mindfully observe your feelings and things like that, that helps you to develop the meditations based on pleasure, okay? Because it helps you to be more equanimous towards your pleasure, right? So the equanimity is also an attitude, right? It's not just a feeling, it's an attitude. And so you can feel the pleasure and you can experience it without getting too excited by it. Okay? And of course this is something that's very common in meditation, in fact, probably universal, right? You're sitting there struggling, meditating, all of this dukkha and stuff like that, and then suddenly all of this rapture comes, or this happiness comes, right? And the very next moment you're like, wow, I've got this rapture, that feels really good, and you get really excited by it, and then you realize, oh, now I'm excited, my mind's not peaceful anymore, and the rapture's gone, okay? So it goes away. So that's one of the reasons why we develop that equanimity towards our feeling. Then when the pleasure comes in our meditation, oh, okay, that pleasure's there, that's nice. But you're not getting excited, right? You can be aware of it. And then when the feeling goes away, because it's impermanent, then you don't regret it or anything like that, but you learn to be able to develop it without being overwhelmed by it. Okay? So this is two sides you need to develop, right? You need to develop those pleasant feelings, but we also need to develop the equanimity regarding those feelings.
Can anyone transform a positive feeling into a neutral or equanimous one?
In what way?
Well, say you're having a recurring thought that's distracting you from your meditation
because
it's pleasant.
Okay.
And it's a sensual pleasure.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you sort of work on that for a few hours, a day, a week, a year, for a lifetime. And eventually you find that you've got a completely neutral feeling about it.
Okay.
But you just don't feel pleasure or pain.
Yeah.
And that would be the economist.
That's right, yeah. I mean, and it's interesting that tends to be how things go, pleasant feelings anyway, right? That's why we have to keep on finding new ones, right?
Yeah.
All the things we used to find so pleasurable,
mm-hmm.
you're like, oh, yeah, actually, there's nothing much to it, you know? And it's just naturally, as you sort of grow and become more mature, your understanding deepens. So,
but it's a lot more conducive to a peaceful meditation. It's not samadhi, but you're having a peaceful meditation.
Sure. Yeah. Mm.
I found that in my meditation institute.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. I think. Heidi, did you have a question?
Just quickly, can you meditate? You're saying going from mutual to favor. What about from painful? Is that likely to happen if you're using pain as a meditation object? Is that likely to go into rapture and stuff like that? Or you
can
likely go through the inequity of, like, is that going to lead to
Mine's kind of complex and unpredictable. So yeah, if you have painful feelings, sometimes, yes, that can lead, you know, directly to a lot of very kind of strong rapture, because you sort of, you know, it sort of forces you to a big letting go. You know, sort of more normally, if you have some kind of painful feeling and then you contemplate it for a while, and then you get a bit of equanimity towards it, and so you can then sort of go on to develop meditation and develop the pleasant feelings in meditation, even though the pain may or may not still be present, but you can still feel the pleasant feelings in meditation. But yeah, sure, sometimes the pain will just lead to a big letting go, you know. I think that's especially the case when you have pain, like painful physical feelings which have an emotional basis to them. Right? And so if you're not necessarily like straight physical feelings, I mean it might be, but if you've got some kind of emotion that you're sort of locking up in your body or you're holding somewhere, and then, you know, you're aware of that for a while and then suddenly the wisdom comes and let go of it, then that can be a very cathartic experience. Yeah. Sorry, take this one.
I was just going to say, can you use the meditating on mutual feelings in the same way, like with your painful feelings?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The difference is that with mutual feelings, you have to like consciously decide to do it, because otherwise you'll just ignore them. With painful feelings, your mind tends to go to them naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry,
Chris.
Yeah. Well, either. Both pleasure and pain are like flags, right? So they draw our attention. The neutral feeling doesn't. Sorry. Yeah. Neutral feeling, anything that isn't painful and pleasurable. Yeah? Like, what do you feel in your left elbow right now? Yeah, yeah. What does that feel like? Yeah, it's a neutral feeling. Yeah, and you see that unlike painful and pleasant feeling, neutral feeling doesn't stimulate any kind of normal response, right? When you pay attention to it, it's just like there's nothing there. Okay. But what's interesting about it, right? When your mindfulness becomes stronger, it's actually quite interesting, because when you look at a neutral feeling, what tends to happen in your mind is that there's like a question mark, right? It's like, what is this? I can't see anything. I can't recognize. There's nothing distinctive about it. And so you have this like feeling in the back of your mind, oh, there's nothing there, you know? And then because of that, the mind kind of wavers and gets bored easily, and then will drift off to something else. So it's actually quite hard to keep your attention with that kind of neutral feeling. But if you stay with it past that, and you just keep your awareness and keep your focus there, just keep watching, then eventually you'll see that actually it has its own kind of distinctive flavour. It's a neutral flavour. It's hard to describe. It's like saying, what colour is white? You know, well, it's just It's just white. but it's got its own kind of tone to it. And when you can focus on that, you see actually it's kind of peaceful. You know? So even though it's neutral feeling, right? It does tend to stimulate either some kind of aversion, right? Because you get bored with it, and you want to look for some pleasure or something. So you shift away from it. But then you can also see the peacefulness of it, and so your mind can be happy to stay there. Yeah.
So, must be one part of the anything.
Can be anything, yeah. I mean, it's easiest just to begin with by focusing on different body parts, but you can do the same thing with thoughts or something like that, right? So you might have like a thought, you remember something very stressful that happened at work or something like that, and it makes you very upset, and then you think, okay, well, let me think about something at work that isn't stressful. So maybe it's the doorknob to the front door of the office, right? And you remember that, and you think, oh yeah, the doorknob was just there, I've never thought about it before. I've opened it every day, and I've never really cared about it. And it's just a doorknob, it does its job. And so you actually remember that, like a memory like that, actually also has its own feelings. And so you notice that actually we only tend to bring up those feelings that are either pleasant or painful, and we ignore all those other ones.
Yeah. You can only do that after you've been married, is that
the way you can do it anytime. Yeah.
Your concentration probably
wouldn't
be as good to do that.
Obviously, if you haven't been in samadhi, your samadhi is not as good. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
How experience this?
Uh-huh.
So if you're in a state of sort of bliss, experiencing that, it doesn't feel different. It's almost like can use a car metaphor. It's almost like this is like the looking at the map, looking at the painful, the neutral. It's almost like bringing success and being in meditation.
Yeah.
I'm inside the meditation. And I can be in a freezing car, you know, watching the world go by, and that's sort of normal state. Mm-hmm. Where I might be uncomfortable. Or I could be a very cozy car watching bright landscape at night.
Right.
And in the meditation state gives me insight. I mean, my mind seemed to do the last meditation a second time. So this was there, where everything's the perception on permanence and self-attachment is so different. So it's all about the how we do
the meditation depending
on sure, of course, yeah. Yeah. And so if that's the case, then what, you know, at what point do we bring in the acceptance? Do we bring in reflection in the meditation? If you're on a journey,
you bring in reflection at the end of the meditation.
So it's almost like my mind just went in.
Yeah. Bring the reflection in only at the end. As we do in all the guided meditations, you set aside time at the end of the meditation for reflecting.
But you might take you on a journey, so then how do you get the journey?
Sorry?
By reading this, will this stimulate my mind to go into the meditation?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully, yeah. But as long as the car gets to the destination, that's the main thing. Yeah. So we're running a few people behind in the questions, and I'm just trying to keep track of who we haven't heard. Who was the next? I don't know, Peter, you had your hand. I think somebody else had their hand up before. Sorry. Okay, anyway, Peter, go on.
Sorry, I just didn't understand the... you said that pleasure is the, like, the key to samadhi, or...
That's right, yeah.
Why specifically pleasure? Why is it necessary? Why?
Because pleasure is sticky.
Easier to get into a state of samadhi.
Not easier, it's only possible to get into a state of samadhi through pleasure. Okay? Because pleasure is sticky. Right? Samadhi comes from stillness, and the stillness comes because your mind wants to stick to something and stay there. So that's the purpose of pleasure. The function of pleasure in the mind is to draw your mind towards it. So this is what it does. It draws your mind towards it and it keeps it there. So when you're meditating, and the process of that meditation is that when in the initial stages of developing samadhi, that pleasure is drawing you towards it and draws you into it, yeah, and it sticks you there firmly, okay? But remember what I said before, that the very fact that it has an attractive force, okay, creates attention to it. So think like a magnet or something like that. So the sukha is like a magnetic force that draws your mind in. But the stronger the magnet is, the more it will draw your mind in. That also means that state is more tense. So what happens then, this is what you see through the description of the four jhanas, is that feeling of pleasure is becoming more and more refined. Yeah? And so eventually, it's as if you have like an electromagnet or something like that. You're turning down the voltage until eventually you can switch it off altogether and it will stay there. And in fact, it's even more stable because there's no tension. Yeah? Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Kim?
In order to get enlightenment, you have to practice neutral feeling all the time. Otherwise, you become attached to pleasant feeling or painful feeling.
No. Pleasure. Be happy. Be happy.
No.
Neutral feeling's alright. Happy feeling's better.
If you're happy, you have a situation. You get attached to it.
No, don't worry about it. Happy. See, you think of happy, see the face you just made. You're like, happy, and then I'm going to make a problem out of being happy. No, don't make a problem out of it. Be happy. And that's the whole point. Is that in the sutra, it says that there are spiritual pleasant feelings, right? Those spiritual pleasant feelings are the feelings that lead you to enlightenment. And those spiritual pleasant feelings are the feelings that we get while we're practicing Dhamma. And those spiritual pleasant feelings arise because of letting go. Okay? You know, when we're kids, you know, one of the phrases we learn is it's better to give than it is to receive. Yeah? And of course, it's not really true when you're a kid. It's quite a lot better to get presents than to give them. But as you grow older, you learn that it really is true, right? And that's precisely those two kinds of happiness, really. The happiness of getting, if someone gives you a present, you're happy to get something. But the happiness of giving is far more profound. That's the happiness of letting go. And that's that spiritual feeling. That's why Dharma is at the basis of the Buddhist path. Yeah? When you give, you feel happy about it. Yeah? When you keep your precepts, all of those things, when you meditate, you feel happy about it.
But isn't letting go the need for feeling?
No. Letting go can be associated with either neutral feeling or pleasant feeling. Okay? But typically letting go, especially, you know, again, like I was saying before, there's an evolution. Right? So but very often letting go relates to happy feeling. Yeah. You put down the burden. And that's what the Buddha talked about talking about letting go of the five hindrances. Yeah? He says, you know, like just like a man who's been released from prison, then they would feel happiness and joy because of that. And that's that feeling of freedom, of release. Yeah. So just be happy. here we go. Yeah. Sorry, I missed that. Yeah. When your mind is very tranquil, you don't want to sleep. Is that what you said? Oh, you sorry. When your mind is very tranquil, you tend to fall asleep. Again, the real answer to that is development of happiness and bliss. When your mind has a rapture in your mind, then it will want to be awake because it wants to experience more of that bliss. When there's a lot of neutral feeling in your mind can be peaceful to a certain degree, but it can, if you do it too long or too much, your mind can then end up falling asleep. So if you find that's happening a lot, then the best solution is to figure out a way to bring more joy into your mind. Don't worry about it. If you're doing breath meditation, just stick with your breath. Okay? We'll do a guided meditation this evening. Yeah? So that might make it a bit clear. We'll definitely do some elbows this evening. Alright? Right. Sort of emotions, we mentioned before the distinction between like Vedana or feeling and emotions, so confidence and faith and so on are all emotions which are associated with the pleasant feelings. Yeah? So the pleasant feelings tend to amplify them. Not always the case, right? I mean, sometimes you can be a person who has faith, but you might not necessarily be happy at that moment, right? But the tendency is that it's associated with a positive emotion.
Yeah, I was just going to share this word, dispassion, which I've learned, which I found very helpful in this retreat, because I don't want to feel the extreme of positive and negative feelings. I would prefer to have this one in the
bed.
Okay. For example, I have a partner who I strongly suspect might be ungrateful to me while I'm in this retreat. And instead of getting into the kind of heart pain about that, I've cultivated this passion so that I now think I don't care whether he is or not.
Okay.
Is that an economic decision or is that just an unrealistic?
Well, it's a very challenging one. Yeah. I can't answer that for you. It depends on your own particular situation.
Yeah.
I remember when Ajahn Brahm gave a talk a few years ago to the Sri Lankan community, and he talked about adultery, and he said, you know, if you discover that your partner's off having a dirty weekend, you should feel happy for them.
Yeah.
You should be like, ah, sadhu, sadhu, have lots of good sex, enjoy yourself. And I don't think that the Sri Lankan community had ever heard of teaching on the third precept quite like that before. It is. And with those kind of situations, you know, you're in a situation which is very, obviously very challenging and, you know, complex, and we need to be aware of not sort of being in denial about it, or not, you know, because it's easy to do, and it's easy to kind of just dismiss it, I don't care, or something like that, and that's another way of kind of not listening. At the same time, though, it is actually possible to be in those situations and be fully aware and fully conscious, and also have that equanimity, and that's what comes with wisdom.
I won't know until I go home. How I actually feel.
Well,
because I mean, I'm in a very comfortable position now. I've got people around me.
Mm.
There's a lot of affection in our cottage and support.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's all very easy to think, oh, I don't care about him anymore. But I think when I go home, I might not be quite so prominent.
Well, you will have all of our everything. Yeah.
Thank you.
Peace and emotion. I haven't thought of that before.
I don't know. Peace is an emotion, but emotion and moving.
Maybe.
There's something that's mutual. You've got to pick on these emotions, which is
mutual. Yeah. Well, certainly peace doesn't always have to be an emotion, right? And you have, like, nirvana is peaceful, but it's not an emotion. But some emotions are relatively peaceful. It's just a matter of terminology, really.
I'm still confused about, maybe I was a little good, but did you say before, when you're meditating on the breath, just meditate on the breath? In the sense that, like, the other day you were talking about how the painful feeling should be eventually, like, unified with the breath.
Mm-hmm.
And so shouldn't you, like, if you're meditating on mutual feeling, shouldn't you be unifying that with the breath?
No. No. See, in this particular, in the Satipatthana Sutta, okay, when it teaches on the three kinds of feelings, right? Painful, pleasant, and neutral feelings, right? Now, in the Anapanasati Sutta, and more generally in the teachings of Anapanasati, it equates the four kinds of Satipatthana with four sets of tetrads in Anapanasati. Okay? Of course, we only looked at the first set, which deals with the awareness of the physical sensation of the breath. Okay? But most of the time it also then goes to the feelings and so on and so forth. Now, the interesting thing is that when it talks about the feelings in regard to breath meditation, it only talks about pleasant feelings. Right? It only talks about rapture and bliss. Yeah? So the whole painful feelings thing is entirely optional, right? You can actually just meditate and only develop those pleasant feelings with the breath, and that's good enough, because actually it's just sankharas, right? They're just conditions, so they're all in there anyway. So actually when you're developing the breath, of course, normally when you begin developing the breath has a kind of neutral feeling, right? But at that stage, you're mainly focusing on the physical sensation of the breath. You're not focusing on the feeling aspect of it. You focus on the feeling aspect of the breath when that becomes prominent because of the arising of those feelings of rapture and bliss.
And then at what stage do you focus on the neutral feeling when...
No, you focus. Oh, sorry. Yes, something like that. Yeah, other kinds of meditation, then you can develop that awareness specifically of neutral feeling. We'll do a guided meditation on that this evening. Okay. Right. Go on.
Having a little bit more prominent in the speech is kind of used to it, in as much as when you're going through that, you can kind of, you don't despair at it, you just kind of...
Sure. It is, yeah. That's very true. And because, you know, it is a reality when we're practicing. And so, you know, sometimes it can get a bit depressing, that spiritual depression, and you're like, oh, you know, meditation is supposed to be peaceful and stuff, and when's that going to happen? Yeah. For sure, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you that all you need to do is focus on the breath when you do it. But it's focusing on the breath that is the issue. So I have had a painful feeling come up the other day. I'm so happy to have this painful feeling.
Uh-huh.
It's so easy to focus on the painful feeling compared to beginning stages of breath meditation where I can get distracted.
Yeah. So what happened then? Excellent. Well, that's good. Well, you're a mother, so, you know, get used to it. No, yeah, sure. And if you know, see, the thing is, and the reason, one of the reasons why that's useful is that then, if you're not afraid of painful feeling, you're also not going to be so infatuated with pleasant feeling. You know, so they always come together. The wisdom will always be there, no matter what you're doing. Yeah.
Do you just use the meditation? You do the meditation in a normal state, and you're doing this sort of blank state, and you use the breath meditation for that.
Kind of.
And if you just say something like that, you're very close.
Yeah. Kind of.
So
which one, sir?
It's Thursday, isn't it?
What day is it today?
It's Thursday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well?
I'm just talking with her.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
We've got Friday and Saturday now. Yeah. I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
All these things that we discussed, offering the feeling, putting the essentially positive stuff.
Right.
All those points, I don't consider it a milestone.
As milestones?
Yeah, you didn't feel it when I wanted to listen. So once you do that, you move to the next one, or you can just like the shortcut.
Think of it more like a framework rather than a milestone. I mean, in some ways, yes, there can be milestones. You know, you can realize, oh, actually, you know, when you're meditating and that pleasant feeling comes, and that wasn't there before, and so there's a certain letting go of hindrances that marks, right? But generally speaking, it's a framework. You know, so it's something that gives you a way of orientating and guiding your practice. It's not like something you sort of achieve step by step.